Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Ages ago, we were looking for some ideas for winter or holiday, like winter or winter holiday episodes. We put out a call on Facebook and what was then called Twitter and stuff like that. Listener Laurie asked for one about the London Frost Fairs, which were essentially festivals that were held out on the ice when the River Thames froze over. So, yes, this is another in our recent line of episodes based on something that somebody asked us for years ago. But we have actually covered a lot of the other topics that were suggested during that call for suggestions, especially the ones that were more specifically about Christmas. So like NORAD's annual tracking of Santa Claus and the Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus story, and Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol and Washington Irving's influence on how Christmas is celebrated in the U.S. Like all of those were suggested during that call for suggestions. This one, though, this is really a winter episode, not a Christmas episode. Most of these fairs took place in January or February, which were usually a little bit colder than December. And this is also a story about climate, although the climate is not the only reason that the last of these fairs took place in 1814.
There are lots of places on Earth where rivers and lakes and other bodies of water freeze over in the winter and are made into roads or are used for other purposes. And in a lot of those places, those frozen bodies of water aren't a novelty like what we're talking about today. They're a critical part of the local infrastructure every winter as people turn them into roads. That's one of the many ways that global warming is already impacting people's lives and livelihoods. As winters get shorter and milder, people living in these areas lose a vital transportation route.
That's really not the case, though, with the River Thames in southern England, especially the part of the river around London. There are reports of this part of the Thames freezing over, going all the way back to the first century, but this wasn't something that happened often at all. And when it did happen, it could be deeply destructive. For example, one account from 1092 reads, quote, "The great streams were congealed in such a manner that they could draw 200 horsemen and carriages over them. Whilst at their thawing, many bridges, both of wood and stone, were borne down, and diverse watermills were broken up and carried away." The part of the Thames that runs from London to the sea also experiences tides, and the rising and falling tides could shift this layer of ice, causing it to damage things that are around it. Or if the ice couldn't move, then the rising water could break out underneath it and then just flood whatever was nearby.
It also took a long period of very cold weather for this stretch of the Thames to freeze, and that wasn't something people were used to or prepared for. So many historical accounts of a frozen Thames also include a lot of references to other cold weather hardships, like people freezing to death or running out of food and fuel and being put out of work when industries had to shut down because of the weather or frozen over waterways. There are also mentions of fundraising efforts to help the poor or the monarch earmarking money or supplies for relief.
The River Thames became somewhat more likely to freeze in London starting around the year 1300, at the start of the period known as the Little Ice Age. This term was coined in 1939 to describe a period of relative cooling that stretched from about 1300 to 1850 or so. Older descriptions of the Little Ice Age often make it sound like an almost continual global period of colder than normal temperatures, but more recent research, including studies of tree rings and ice cores, suggests that this was a more complicated phenomenon.
Globally, the average temperature was slightly colder than the 1,000-year average between the years 1000 and 2000. But this was also relative, because the Little Ice Age followed a warmer stretch known as the Medieval Warming Period, which spanned from about 900 to 1300. Some parts of the world, including much of northern and western Europe, were generally colder during the Little Ice Age. Glaciers expanded in some areas, including the European Alps, New Zealand, Alaska, and the southern Andes. But other areas were relatively warmer. Some regions also faced much wetter weather during these centuries, while others experienced prolonged drought. So it wasn't just that temperatures in some regions were getting generally colder. The overall weather tended to be more extreme. And we don't know exactly why this happened, but possible causes include volcanic activity, changes in atmospheric circulation and ocean currents, and low solar output. There are two known periods of very reduced sunspot activity during these centuries, which is believed to correspond to lower output from the sun.
The Little Ice Age is not the only reason that the River Thames periodically froze over in London during these centuries. Another is the Old London Bridge, which was completed in 1209. This bridge was built with 19 arches, and each of those was built, like the feet of them were built on piers that extended out into the water. So the space under each of these arches was narrow, and as the river started to freeze, ice could collect around those piers. It basically created a dam that slowed or stopped the river. The river itself was also wider and slower moving than it is today, and it's easier for that slower moving water to freeze.
The first reports of people setting up tents or booths on the frozen Thames date back to the year 695, and there are accounts of various activities happening on the ice in the 15th and 16th centuries. But the term frost fairs wasn't used until the 17th century. The River Thames through London is known to have developed ice thick enough to walk on at least 24 times between 1600 and 1814, and those are the centuries that are associated with occasional frost fairs.
At least some of these fairs were spearheaded by people who had been put out of work by the river freezing over, especially watermen who moved passengers around the Thames by boat, and lightermen who did the same but with cargo. Watermen and lightermen were often the ones to declare the surface of the Thames safe to walk on based on their own judgment, and they also did things like build little bridges to help people get from the shore out onto the ice. Since they weren't being paid to ferry passengers or cargo, they would basically make up for it by collecting tolls for using these temporary bridges.
At the same time, these fairs were somewhat spontaneous, starting once people thought the ice could support a crowd, and ending as warmer weather made the ice start to thaw. Vendors set up shops and little food stalls. There was lots and lots of food and drink. A little bit of it is still around. There's some gingerbread from the 1814 fair in the collection of the Museum of London. There were also activities like ice skating and bowling and archery, as well as blood sports like bull baiting. In 1814, there was even an elephant brought onto the ice.
I can't imagine that elephant was happy about that.
No.
There were also lots of souvenirs, things like mugs, spoons, and other household objects that were engraved with the fact that they had been bought at the frost fair. One souvenir that showed up at multiple fairs was printed materials. So people would set up a printing press on the ice and then print tickets with people's names and the date, or add people's printed names to like a personalization area on something like a souvenir woodcut. These would often say something like, quote, printed by C. Croom on the ice on the River Thames. That's a real example. It came from a ticket that was printed for King Charles II and members of the royal family and court in 1684.
Aside from these souvenirs, we have tons of written documentation related to these fairs. People's correspondence, diaries, newspapers, histories, and chronicles of London written during these centuries. It just goes on and on. There were at least six major frost fairs on the Thames between 1607 and 1814, as well as various smaller events, and there is so much surviving written material about them. We're going to hit some highlights from the 17th century after we pause for a sponsor break.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
As we said before the break, there were times before the 17th century that the River Thames froze and people had some kind of event out on the ice in London, but the first one to be described as a frost fair was in 1607. That year, the Thames upstream of the London Bridge froze over for 6 weeks. The ice was thick enough to walk on by late December, but it was really in January that the fair got going on the ice.
One of the things to come out of this fair was a pamphlet titled The Great Frost, Cold Doings in London, Accept It to Be at the Lottery, with news out of the country, a familiar talk between a countryman and a citizen touching this terrible frost and the great lottery and the effects of them, the description of the Thames frozen over.
So this is written as a dialogue between a citizen, that being a city person, and a countryman. And it kicks off with, quote, a table of the most special matters of note contained in this short discourse. Those special matters are, quote, one, a description of the Thames being frozen over. Two, the dangers that hath happened to some persons passing upon the Thames. 3, the harms that this frost hath done to the city. 4, the misery that the country people are driven into by the means of this frost. 5, the frosts in other kings' times compared with this. 6, a description of the lottery.
The citizen explains to the countryman that, quote, the Thames began to put on his frieze coat, which yet he wears, about the week before Christmas. And he makes it clear that this freezing weather was dangerous and difficult. He describes people falling through weak patches in the ice, some of them up to their knees or their armpits, and all the way under, with some of those last never being seen again. And he says that a lot of people are out of work because of the ice, forced into what they called the dead vacation, the frozen vacation, the cold vacation. The citizen talks about how much the poor were being charged for candles and wood, and how much they were suffering because of it.
The countryman says it is just as bad out where he lives. Quote, the poor plowman's children sit crying and blowing their nails as lamentably as the children and servants of your poor artificers. Hunger pinches their cheeks as deep into the flesh as it doth into yours here. You cry out here, you are undone for coal, and we complain we shall die for want of wood. All your care is to provide for your wives, children, and servants in this time of sadness. But we go beyond you in cares. Not only our wives, our children, and household servants are unto us a cause of sorrow, but we grew as much to behold the misery of our poor cattle in this frozen-hearted season as it doth to look upon our own affliction.
At the same time, the citizen makes the fare on the Thames sound like a lot of fun. Quote, thirst you for beer, ale, usquebaugh, etc., or for victuals? There you may buy it, because you may tell another day how you dined upon the Thames. Are you cold with going over? You shall, ere you come to the midst of the river, spy some ready with pans of coals to warm your fingers. If you want fruit after you have dined, there stands costermongers to serve you at your call. And thus do people leave their houses and the streets, turning the goodliest river in the whole kingdom into the broadest street to walk in.
If you're thinking, wasn't there something about the lottery in the name of this pamphlet and the table of contents? This sounds more like what we might describe as a raffle of, quote, spoons, cups, bowls, basins, ewers, etc., fairly graven and richly gilded. This was similar to a lottery that had been arranged under Queen Elizabeth I to raise money for public projects, but this one, according to this account, was set up by strangers. Also, usquebaugh was listed in the drinks you could get. That is usquebaugh, which is a type of whiskey,
which I have
like an early type of whiskey.
Never heard of, despite my years of enjoying beverages. Edmund House has a more straightforward description of the 1607 fair in his continuation of the abridgment of Stowe's English Chronicle. Quote, from Sunday, the 10th of January, until the 15th of the same, the frost grew so extreme as the ice became firm and removed not, and then all sorts of men, women, and children went boldly upon the ice in most parts. Some shot at pricks, others bowled and danced with other variable pastimes, by reason of which concourse of people were many that set up booths and standings upon the ice as fruit sellers, victuallers that sold beer and wine, shoemakers, and a barber's tent, etc.
Just a note, I think shot at pricks means they did some archery. Another major fair was held during the Great Frost of 1683 to 1684. This one was known as the Blanket Fair, possibly because the booths were made of blankets draped over the oars that the watermen couldn't use because everything was frozen over. There's a reference to this in a broadside ballad that was printed in 1684, which includes the lines, quote, in roast beef and brandy, much money is spent in booths made of blankets that pay no ground rent. This ballad, which is pretty long, makes the frozen Thames sound very dangerous at night, suggesting that the people who do not stay home safely warm in their beds might wind up being pickpocketed or sexually assaulted. There are definitely a lot of reports of pickpocketing in all of these fairs, as is often the case with very crowded festival-type places.
This fair was also documented by famed diarist John Evelyn. That year, the river was iced over for about 2 months. Evelyn noted that the river was frozen on January 6th, and 3 days later he wrote, quote, "I went across the Thames on the ice, now become so thick as to bear not only streets of booths in which they roasted meat and had diverse shops of wares, quite across as in a town, but coaches, carts, and horses passed over. So I went from Westminster Stairs to Lambeth and dined with the Archbishop, where I met my Lord Bruce, Sir George Wheeler, Colonel Cook, and several divines. After dinner and discourse with His Grace till evening prayers, Sir George Wheeler and I walked over the ice from Lambeth Stairs to the Horse Ferry."
On the 16th, Evelyn described the Thames as filled with people in tents, quote, "selling all sorts of wares as in the city." Then on the 24th, he wrote, quote, "The frost continues more and more severe. The Thames, before London, was still planted with booths and formal streets, all sorts of trades and shops furnished, and full of commodities, even to a printing press, where the people and ladies took a fancy to have their names printed, and the day of the year set down when printed on the Thames. This humor took so universally that it was estimated that the printer gained £5 a day for printing a line only at sixpence a name, besides what he got by ballads, etc. Coaches plied from Westminster to the Temple and from several other stairs to and fro, as in the streets, sleds, sliding with skates, a bull baiting, horse and coach races, puppet plays and interludes, cooks, tippling, and other lewd places, so that it seemed to be a bacchanalian triumph or carnival on the water."
His description of what was going on land at the same time isn't nearly so cheerful, though. Quote, "The trees not only splitting as if the lightning struck, but men and cattle perishing in diverse places, and the very seas so locked up with ice that no vessels could stir out or come in. The fowls, fish, and birds, and all our exotic plants and greens, universally perishing. Many parks of deer were destroyed, and all sorts of fuel so dear that there were great contributions to preserve the poor alive. Nor was this severe weather much less intense in most parts of Europe, even as far as Spain and the most southern tracts. London, by reason of the excessive coldness of the air hindering the ascent of the smoke, was so filled with the fuliginous steam of the sea coal that hardly could one see across the street, and this filling the lungs with its gross particles exceedingly obstructed the breast, so as one could scarcely breathe. Here was no water to be had from the pipes and engines, nor could the brewers and divers other tradesmen work, and every moment was full of disastrous accidents."
Many of the frost fairs were commemorated in art and verse, and this was no exception. Charles II ordered the creation of a panoramic description of the fair, as well as a collection of funds for the poor who were struggling because of the weather that made the fair possible.
And here's a poem commemorating the 1684 fair. "Behold the wonder of this present age. A famous river now becomes a stage. Question not what I now declare to you. The Thames is now both fair and market too, and many thousands daily to resort there to behold the pastime and the sport, early and late, used by young and old, and valued not the fierceness of the cold."
And just because I found it delightful, here's the title of one of the print works that came out after this fair. Quote, "An historical account of the late great frost, in which are discovered in several comical relations the various humors, loves, cheats, and intrigues of the town, as the same were managed upon the River Thames during that season."
We'll move on to the 18th century and the eventual end of the frost fairs after a sponsor break.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
There were three major frost fairs in the 18th century, and the first was in 1716. Here's a description from Dox's newsletter, dated January 14th. Quote, "The Thames seems now a solid rock of ice, and booths for the sale of brandy, wine, ale, and other exhilarating liquors have been for some time fixed thereon. But now it is in a manner like a town. Thousands of people cross it and with wonder view the mountainous heaps of water that now lie congealed into ice. On Thursday, a great cook's shop was erected and gentlemen went as frequently to dine there as at any ordinary. Over against Westminster, Whitehall, and Whitefriars, printing presses are kept upon the ice where many persons have their names printed to transmit the wonders of the season to posterity."
Here's a description of the winter that made a frost fair possible a little more than 20 years later in 1739, which was reprinted in the 1887 book Famous Frosts and Frost Fairs in Great Britain, chronicled from the earliest to the present time. It reads, quote, "The watermen and fishermen, with a Peter boat in mourning, and the carpenters, bricklayers, etc., with their tools and utensils in mourning, walked through the streets in large bodies, imploring relief for their own and family's necessities. And to the honor of the British character, this was liberally bestowed. Subscriptions were also made in the different parishes, and great benefactions bestowed by the opulent, through which the calamities of the season were much mitigated."
The same account reports huge damage to the shipping trade on the Thames below the bridge, with vessels being damaged by ice floes and breaking away from their moorings, crashing into things, with smaller vessels being sunk entirely. But at the same time, quote, "above the bridge, the Thames was completely frozen over, and tents and numerous booths were erected on it for selling liquors, etc., to the multitudes that daily flocked thither for curiosity or diversion. The scene here displayed was very irregular and had more the appearance of a fair on land than of a frail exhibition, the only basis of which was congealed water."
50 years later, in 1789, visitors to the Frost Fair could buy a souvenir print with this verse. "The silver Thames was frozen o'er, no difference twixt the stream and shore. The like no man hath seen before, except he lived in days of yore. On the ice at the Thames printing office, opposite St. Catherine's Stairs in the severe frost, January 1789, printed by me, William Bailey."
I love the printed by me part. Not just printed by William Bailey, printed by me, William Bailey.
I wrote this and I'm doing it.
That year, the London Chronicle recorded how treacherous a fair could be as the weather started to warm. on January 15th that printed this, quote, "Perhaps the breaking up of the fair upon the Thames last Tuesday night below bridge exceeded every idea that could be formed of it, as it was not until after the dusk of the evening that the busy crowd was persuaded of the approach of a thaw. This, however, with the cracking of some ice about 8 o'clock, made the whole a scene of most perfect confusion, as men, beasts, booths, turnabouts, puppet shows, etc., were all in motion and pouring towards the shore on each side. The confluence here was so sudden and impetuous that the watermen who had formed the toll bars over the sides of the river, where they had broken the ice for that purpose, not being able to maintain their standard from the crowd, etc., pulled up the boards by which a number of persons who could not leap or were borne down by the press were soused up to the middle."
The breakup of the ice also led to at least one tragedy that year. As described in the Gentleman's Magazine, quote, "The captain of a vessel lying off Rotherhithe, the better to secure the ship's cables, made an agreement with a publican for fastening a cable to his premises. In consequence, a small anchor was carried on shore and deposited in the cellar, while another cable was fastened round a beam in another part of the house. In the night, the ship veered about, and the cables holding fast carried away the beam and leveled the house with the ground, by which accident 5 persons asleep in their beds were killed."
London's last frost fair was held in 1814, and it was probably the largest of them, even though it only lasted a few days. The temperature was below freezing overnight from late December to the early weeks of February, but it was really only at the end of January and beginning of February that the ice was thick enough to really support a crowd. Like the fairs that came before, this one featured a whole lot of food and drink. We talked about that gingerbread at the top of the episode. There particularly was an emphasis on gin, according to what I read.
Well, yeah. An entire book resulted from this frost fair, which is titled Frostiana, or A History of the River Thames in a Frozen State, and the Wonderful Effects of Frost, Snow, Ice, and Cold in England, and in different parts of the world, interspersed with various amusing anecdotes, to which is added The Art of Skating. The title page of this book claims that it was, quote, "printed and published on the ice on the River Thames, February 5th, 1814, by G. Davis." It later clarifies that what was printed on the ice was the title page and not the entire book.
Yeah, it did not make logistical sense that it was the whole book. But because that's on the title page, some people have taken it that way. This book describes previous frost fairs, along with the freezing of the Thames more generally. Plus, there are chapters on cold weather phenomena like ice and snow. There's also an assortment of other stuff related to cold and water, sometimes tenuously related, including an ice cream recipe and instructions on how to save someone from drowning. And as that title suggests, there is information on ice skating, including rules for learners.
This sounds like a great book to me. I want it.
I mean, you can read it for free on the internet.
Great.
I could send you a PDF.
If you have doubts about the feasibility of learning ice skating from a book, here is how that part begins. Quote, "Those who wish to be proficient should begin in an early period of life and should first endeavor to throw off the fear which always attends the commencement of an apparently hazardous amusement. They will soon acquire a facility of moving on the inside. When they have done this, they must endeavor to acquire the movement on the outside of the skates, which is nothing more than throwing themselves upon the outer edge of the skate and making the balance of their body tend toward that side, which will necessarily enable them to form a semicircle. In this, much assistance may be derived from placing a bag of lead shot in the pocket next to the foot employed in making the outside stroke, which will produce an artificial poise of the body. This afterwards will become natural by practice." Well, of course, there you go. Now I know how to ice skate.
Perfectly clear.
Just
I don't know.
Stop being afraid and put some buckshot in your pocket.
Frostiana includes a day-by-day description of this fair, including various things that were for sale and how much they cost, such as, quote, "Among the more curious of these was the ceremony of roasting a small sheep, which was toasted, or rather burnt, over a coal fire placed in a large iron pan. For a view of this extraordinary spectacle, 6 pence was demanded and willingly paid. The delicate meat, when done, was sold at 1 shilling a slice and termed Lapland mutton. of booths, there were a great number which were ornamented with streamers, flags, and signs, and in which there was a plentiful store of those favorite luxuries, gin, beer, and gingerbread.
By February 4th, the author sounds kind of annoyed by the whole thing. Quote, every day brought a fresh accession of peddlers to sell their wares, and the greatest rubbish of all sorts was raked up and sold at double and treble the original cost. Books and toys labeled bought on the Thames were seen in profusion. The watermen profited exceedingly, for each person paid a toll of 2 pence or 3 pence before he was admitted to Frost Fair. Some douceur also was expected on your return. These men are said to have taken 6 pounds each in the course of a day.
Frostiana also describes the thawing conditions at the end of this fair as kind of frightening. Quote, towards the evening, the concourse became thinned. Rain fell in some quantity. Maester Ice gave some loud cracks and floated with the printing presses, booths, etc., and to the no small dismay of publicans, typographers, etc. In short, this icy palace of Momus, this fairy frostwork, was soon to be dissolved and doomed to vanish like the baseless fabric of a vision, but leaving some wrecks behind.
There is also this description from February 6th, after the fair had ended, and the fate of a booth that was still lingering on the ice. Quote, the booth just mentioned was hurried along with the quickness of lightning towards Blackfriars Bridge. There were 9 men in it, and in their alarm they neglected the firing candles, which, communicating with the covering, set it in a flame. The men succeeded in getting into a lighter which had broken from its moorings, but it was dashed to pieces against one of the piers of Blackfriars Bridge, on which 7 of them got and were taken off safely. The other 2 got into a barge while passing Puddle Dock.
So those folks seem to have been okay, but according to famous frosts and frost fairs, there was also a tragedy at the end of this one. Quote, 2 genteel-looking young men fell victims to their temerity in venturing on the ice above Westminster Bridge, notwithstanding the warnings of the watermen. A large mass on which they stood and which had been loosened by the flood tide gave way, and they floated down the stream. As they passed under Westminster Bridge, they cried out most piteously for help. They had not gone far before they sat down, but going too near the edge, they overbalanced the mass and were precipitated into the stream, sinking not to appear again.
A couple of humorous bits of print material marked the end of this fair. One was a souvenir ticket that read, notice, whereas you, J. Frost, have by force and violence taken possession of the River Thames, I hereby give you warning to quit immediately. A Thaw, printed by S. Warner on the ice, February 5th, 1814.
Then there was also this one, quote, dear dissolving dame, Father Frost and Sister Snow have honeyed my borders, formed an idol of ice upon my bosom, and the lads of London come to make merry. Now, as you love mischief, treat the multitude with a few cracks by a sudden visit and obtain the prayers of the poor upon both banks. Given at my own press, the 5th February, 1814, Thomas Thames.
I don't know why the phrase honeyed my borders sounds filthy to me. I'm like, all right then. That 1814 Frost Fair was the last one. One reason was that the Little Ice Age ended around 1850, and the planet has continued to get warmer since then. Very broadly speaking, London is an average of about 2 degrees Celsius warmer today than it was during the age of the frost fairs. But another factor is that the old London Bridge was demolished in 1831, and its replacement had only 5 arches with far more room between them. And that made it easier for boats to navigate under the bridge, but it also made it much harder for ice to create a dam there. The Thames River was also dredged in the 19th century, and stone embankments were built between 1864 and 1874, so it is a deeper and faster-moving river than it was prior to the 19th century.
Yeah, I think even if it got a lot colder, it would be a lot harder for the Thames to freeze there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If it did freeze there, it would be a, like, day-after-tomorrow apocalypse horror movie situation. I mean, we're facing a different situation with the warming of the planet, but, like, that would be just a drastic shift in climate based on the trajectory that we're on currently.
Yeah. I'm sort of waiting for someone to be like, we'll do a man-made blocking of the Thames and cause it to freeze over, and that leading to some sort of magical film-level disaster.
It does seem like something somebody
would do.
Yeah.
Do you have listener mail for us?
I do. It is from Mara. And Mara wrote, Holly and Tracy, I just finished your episode on Christine Quintasket, and I made sure I sat down and listened to it during a time when I could really pay attention. I've lived my entire life here in Washington, and I have to admit, I had never heard about Christine. I was so happy to hear the story of an Indigenous woman so close to my home. I live very close to Medical Lake and often walk and drive near the hospital where she died, and have hiked and backpacked the foothills and plains of the Okanagan. The eastern side of the state is wildly different from the drizzly and damp Seattle region and has a completely different beauty to it. I'm so glad Christine fought so hard to maintain the history and beauty of it and document the culture of the people who have called it home for millennia. I was particularly impressed with the attention you both paid to pronunciation of names and regions and towns in Washington. Most people manage to butcher the pronunciation of Colville, not to mention Oglala and Okanagan. I'm also attaching a recent news article about how tribes in Washington are working to restore the presence of the bison on native lands. Attached is my pet tax. As stated in the subject, it will be excessive. I did not read the subject, but it does say mourning dove and excessive pet tax. I have way too many animals. 4 cats, a dog, and 3 horses. Here are Lilith and Evie, my spoiled orange house cats, Betty Lou and Grumps, the mischievous sister farm kitties, and my horse, Mickey, and her adorable companion, Nutella, the 30-year-old wonder mini horse, Indy, the world's most cuddly cattle dog, and Naomi, my heart horse and adventure companion, Mara. So these are great pictures of so many animals. Oh, goodness. Orange kitties in a basket.
I mean, I think that seems like the right number of animals. If you can take care of them,
yeah,
no problem.
I mean, yes. If I had, you know, a farm, I would for sure have more animals than we have currently. I wanted to read this note for a couple reasons. One, what great animal pictures.
Yes.
Two, I will definitely admit that I said Colville as Colville in my head before going to look it up as a just in case, because it is spelled like you would think just based on patterns of, you know, how words are often pronounced in English, that it's Colville, but it is Colville. And I actually found, as I was working on the pronunciations for that episode, a couple of different contradictory pronunciations for Okanagan. There was also Okanagan, which I think is a more like a Salish language pronunciation, and one that almost like didn't really have the final syllable on it at all. So I think there are some variations on that regionally. And I was very interested with this article about introducing some buffalo as a food sovereignty effort. We did not talk about it in this episode. These bison, I think, came from Yellowstone. A lot of the efforts to reintroduce bison in the United States, the bison have come from Canada, which is where the bison from the U.S. were sent to.
Right.
In the episodes on Mourning Dove. So thank you so much for sending this article. And these horse pictures and cat pictures and dog pictures.
Yay!
I love them.
Puppies and kitties and horsies.
Yeah. If you'd like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever else you like to get your podcasts. And I also usually say you can send us a note if you like at historypodcast@iHeartRadio.com. But now I think I might have said that already. I interrupted my normal flow of the show outro.
Uh-uh.
And now I don't remember what I've said and what I haven't. So if for the 3 or 4 people still listening this late in the episode, you know now that sometimes it goes off the rails. So yeah, thanks for listening. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.